You're listening to KPPP LP FM Radio.
I still hear my brother crying, I can't breathe. So now I'm in the struggle singing, I can't leave. We called it out the violence of these racist police. And we ain't gonna stop till our people are free. And we ain't gonna stop till our people are free. I still hear my brother crying, I can't breathe. So now I'm in the struggle singing, I can't leave. We call it out the violence of these racist police. And we ain't gonna stop till our people are free. We ain't gonna stop till our people are free. I still hear my brother crying, I can't breathe. So now I'm in the struggle singing, I can't leave. We calling out the violence of these racist police. And we ain't gonna stop till our people are free. We ain't gonna stop till our people are free.
Hey, you're listening to Cindy Gomez Shemp, and this is A Mexican Crossing Lines. You're listening to KPPPLPFM. We are broadcasting online through Live 365, and you can soon find us on your radio dial at 88.1 FM. We are adding local color to your airwaves. And tonight we're talking about Ms. Yu and all of the protests that are going on across the country in universities. I have in studio with me two very special guests, and one is my daughter Elizabeth.
Hello.
And the other is our very special guest, Avi Blackmore. Thanks for coming back again.
Hi, thanks for having me.
The last time you were here, we were talking about hypocrisy, right?
That is the case, yes.
Hypocrisy at its finest. And we might be able to weave some of that into today's discussion about American education, but
It's an endless fount in this country, or any human country really, but this one especially.
But I think that this discussion about what's happening at Ms. Yu has really erupted, not just with the discussion about racism in the school, but the discussion about the cost of education, higher level education in college. Mm-hmm. And there has been in our local media especially a very scary narrative about how what's really happening at this university is PC police controlling our lives and minds and making us think that these folks, including this president and Ms. Yu, have somehow been abused.
Lynched, I believe, was the word used by that guest post at
Valley News Live.
Valley News Live, thank you. Mm-hmm. I was trying to remember if it was Valley News Live specifically or the 630.
It was posted on 630 POV, but it was, I think, a Valley News Live
right.
guest post.
Yeah, that. Who was the author of that again?
I can't remember. I think I blocked it out purposely.
I had it on my. Well, actually, it was your cell phone, but
yeah,
I didn't recognize the name. You said he was from Grand Forks.
Yep, I was actually tagged in the post by a friend of mine, and he said that it was a Grand Forks writer journalist. Actually,
is that what passes for journalism these days?
I believe he's a radio announcer.
Oh, that's right. He's in radio, but he had put his wordsmithing to use in this latest Valley News Live post. I had never seen those. Duke, did...
Nope, this is the first time I've ever seen a guest post put on. In fact, the Valley News Live Facebook page is now where you... I can't comment on it. I can only read posts, or I can share them, but I can't like them. I can't comment. But there's still public people posting on them. And they had a button on there that said sign up, and that button's now gone. And there's been some reports of people who say they are blocked from actually commenting on those pages, and I'm one of them.
Yeah, many, many other people that are local friends of mine, actually, in progressive circles have commented about how they've been banned from commenting on that radio, I mean, on that TV stations.
Well, it makes sense. In order to ensure that no one is controlled and shouted down by the PC police, you have to ban anyone who says anything that they don't like.
PC police.
Well, yeah.
Those scary people with you know, they have combat garb on and they come in and they
come and they wave their fingers at you and shame you for using bigoted language. Yeah, it's I was just reading an article about this the other day. Actually, I shared it on my Facebook. I think you saw it, but it was about how basically if you're going to use the rhetoric of PC police, comparing people who are speaking out against bigotry with their words to police who use force, often lethal force, against people of color in this country all the time, and in unwarranted levels of force at that, you've really lost the plot. If your idea of oppression is being reprimanded, using the rhetoric of police oppression that is actual physical violence or of lynching, it's just complete lack of proportionality.
There's another thing about this media analysis that I really want to get to, because there's been a lot of these kind of baited stories. I want to say they're baited because if they feel like they're like a lever, like they're there as a trap for you to go, and they put a headline on there like, there's a survey that says that in Fargo, Moorhead, most people don't want refugees here. How do you feel about that? You know, and it's like this. The gut reaction of seeing an inflammatory headline makes you go, what? I got to go see that. And what's this about?
Clickbait, basically.
Yeah. And I'm wondering with regard to this MISU, because, you know, we've seen on social media, you and I have seen this on social media, there's a lot of contrast between the discussion about the racism that people are claiming they're experiencing and what people believe is actually happening to Black students on that campus.
Well, I'm not quite sure what you're asking in this case. Do you
I'm asking whether or not the media is feeding this narrative of questioning, because we all know that racism exists in 2015 America.
Yes.
It's not like we don't know that. So,
some tell it, it's a great revelation, but
yeah, right. But we know that it exists, and especially in Missouri. Okay, it's not like it's a far-fetched idea. This is, after all, where Michael Brown was killed. This is the epicenter of a lot of what became the Black Lives Matter movement in this country. So for people to have this like, are people there really in danger? I think this is kind of far-fetched. And calling into question the experience of these Black students that are saying they are feeling threatened.
Well, I guess my response would just be that the narrative that especially conservative media are pushing is, of course, going to try and uphold the power structure that they value. So when they say that we have no evidence that racist incidents took place,
like the poop swastika,
right?
Pictures,
right? Apparently there is, however, a police report which I saw, which was taken by a campus police officer. The name was omitted. It was redacted by the campus police, but they did release photographs of the police report with identifying details blanked out so that they didn't, because they didn't want to compromise the investigation.
Right.
But the officer testified in the report that he personally saw.
And this is a sworn testimony.
Oh, yeah. You know, they don't lie in their reports. If the report would make them look bad and they tell something that makes them look bad, you can pretty much assume they're not going to lie in that report. Because, sure, if you asked me, do I trust police? I would say, well, no. I mean, they have as much a chance of lying as anyone else, and sometimes they have a vested interest in lying.
An incentive, yeah.
What is the incentive in this case? In this case, the incentive generally for campus police is try and downplay any incidents on campus because they might make the school look bad. That's the pressure. And so if the officer testifies in their police report, I saw a swastika drawn in feces in this bathroom.
Mm-hmm.
If they say that they saw this, I don't have a reason to disbelieve them because the incentive would be for them to deny that they saw it.
Right. You would think that they would try to keep campus running because, after all, the university is a business.
Sure.
And so this conversation coincides with this million student march.
Yes, it does.
So they brought in this... another aspect. There are layers to this conversation about what's happening at Mizzou, and we kind of talked a little bit about this off air before we got on topic here, where we were talking about the history of the athletes protesting, and the fact that there's kind of a history of athletes in the past protesting. Do you want to walk us a little bit through some of the history of what and the idea that athletes need to be paid and the you know the kind of
Well, as far as the general exploitation of student athletes, I would just point anyone to John Oliver's Last Week Tonight segment on the matter, which you can find on their YouTube channel. He said it far better and in far greater depth than I can cover here. Specifically, I didn't read a very great deal about it. I wish I had had the chance, but apparently there was a case some 40 years ago when a group of black athletes at Mizzou... actually tried the same thing. They tried to go on strike from their football team in protest of racist treatment by the administration and a lack of protection and a lack of follow-up on dealing with racist incidents on campus. And again, I wish I'd read more about this. All I know, based on what I saw in the small article I saw, is that it failed. And the reason I think it failed is partly because racism was more acceptable back then than it is now. Not to say that things are great now, but, you know. The other thing, though, is that in the 70s, college football was not the same kind of big money that it is today.
Right.
It was important as far as the school was concerned, but it wasn't the primary source of a lot of their funding the way that it is these days. College football is a big business, and big business built on the backs of unpaid labor. And so if that unpaid labor is dissatisfied enough to go on strike, and to go on hunger strike no less, the trustees are going to start turning to the administration and saying, "We're going to lose money over this. You need to put a stop to this. Do something." Which is probably what happened at Mizzou this time when Wolf resigned. That was his name. Tim Wolf, was it?
Yeah. What do you think about this comparison that was made in Valley News Live about this guy as being lynched, or his career being lynched, due process being lynched, the education system being lynched?
I think that if he had really gone to great effort, he might have been able to find a more egregiously offensive and thoughtless and just plain cruel way of putting it, and frankly histrionic way of putting it than he did. But he would have had to go to a lot of effort. And
don't you think that, I mean... what kind of effort did Valley News Live go to put this story out there?
Well, judging by the editing job done on that article, not good. Some of those sentences weren't even proper sentences. I mean, it wasn't quite so bad as "this sentence, no verb," but sorry.
Yeah.
You know, exactly like what happened right there, where I had completely the wrong words put together in the wrong order.
Yeah.
You know, it was had. What was I doing there? Well, yes. At least I stopped myself and said, "That sentence isn't working. Start again." This guy just put it down on the page and published it with absolutely tangled syntax, but I'm not here to be a grammar
czar,
a grammar critic. I'm here to criticize what he said more than how he said it. And
I'm here to criticize the news station that would put that out as news.
That's right. In fact, Valley News Live put it on their webpage. So it is owned and originated from Valley News Live. And it was done by a guy named Brad Schmidt
from
Grand Forks, who has a radio show on 1310 KNOX 107.9.
Thank you, Deaconess.
And ironically,
thanks for digging that up for us.
Ironically, the name of the show is the Schmidt Show. And, you know, it's almost a word we can't say on radio.
Well, you know, you could go there. I say perhaps.
Well,
and
the news over at Valley News Live lately in their comment section has definitely looked like a Schmidt show. It definitely has.
This is going to become new lingo around here, I'm
almost certain. Oh, yeah. But that's definitely a Schmidt show over there.
But getting back to the lynching thing, I just find it yet again shows a complete lack of sense of proportionality to compare someone voluntarily, albeit under some pressure, stepping down from a position of authority and no doubt getting some kind of compensation package.
Of course.
And severance pay, with being hung from a tree and then set on fire.
Murdered.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Murdered in an act of genocide, actually.
For entertainment.
And as a form of terrorism.
Mm-hmm.
And comparing mild censure to, I mean,
it's, I know.
The guy invoked due process.
I know.
And said that this was a violation of due process. Well, due process is a matter for courts.
Right.
As you well know. I mean, you're a paralegal.
Yeah.
And courts were not even anywhere near this whole situation.
Certainly
it was a
no
matter
criminal
of,
process and definitely no civil process.
Yeah, it was a matter of public protest, which was lawful,
mm-hmm.
and then a matter of the strike by the Mizzou football team.
Well, there
which was
no
lawful.
Criminal process to remove Nixon, but he resigned, didn't he?
There was a criminal process being begun. Articles
but
of impeachment were being drafted.
But it didn't happen.
True, because he resigned first.
Because he resigned first, and this is Tim Wolf.
But that was
on.
That was not a miscarriage of justice either.
Of course either.
That was not a violation of due process. That was basically...
No one said Nixon was lynched.
Well, I don't...
Were there some people that did? Oh, my God.
I've read some stuff from the period. You know, your William F. Buckley stuff from back in the day.
God.
But...
Well, that, I mean, it sounds very histrionic, but...
No more so than this Schmidt guy.
Exactly.
So, basically, going and arguing that due process had anything to do with the situation, it's not just a red herring. It's a red herring with fur and possibly feathers. It's complete nonsense. And then to go on and state that education was lynched because this one professor, what was his name? Bergman?
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah. Let's talk about that guy.
Yeah. He said, well, I've heard that there are some people who are saying that they've
essentially been... He was dismissing the fears of black people.
Yes, I was. Yeah, exactly. A number of, there were threats against black students on campus, which people have been arrested for now.
Mm-hmm.
It is considered a terrorist act,
and
although...
which many people were questioning were even threats before the hand.
Of course.
But people have now been arrested. So
yes.
For those of you just tuning in right now, you're listening to Ms. Yu, this is the topic today on A Mexican Crossing Lines. I'm here with Avi Blackmore.
Avi,
sorry. I keep doing that to you.
Actually, you haven't done it in a while. Go on.
Avi and Cindy Gomez-Shep. And we're talking about racism on college campuses, but we're talking about the whole thing about the college uprising.
Mm-hmm.
The million student march.
We haven't gotten to the economic part yet.
Yeah, we will. But...
We will. But as far as saying that this professor had said that in response to these threats being sent to black students, Well, I'm still having the exam tomorrow. If you don't want to come to class, don't come to class, but I'm not doing a makeup. If you let the bullies intimidate you, then the bullies win. Which
is... What do you think of that?
I think that as someone who was bullied as a kid, the whole... And this is a whole other topic, which I'm only going to lightly touch on because we could do a whole show about bullying.
Sure.
But there's a general belief that the way to stop bullying is to have the person who is being bullied just not let it get to them. Just show the bullies that you don't care, that it's not affecting you, and then they'll stop because they're bored, because they, you know, they only do it to make you react, to get a reaction out of you, and if you don't react, then they won't keep doing it. And it's a very wrong-headed view of how people act, A, because that isn't why people bully. People don't bully to get a rise out of you. People bully because they enjoy exerting power over others.
Right, it's
others.
A power structure thing.
Right, and they don't really care what the bullied person thinks about it. They're just doing it because by asserting their power, they get some kind of pleasure out of that.
Mm-hmm.
And pretending not to be affected by it, which I tried as a kid, it just makes them try harder because they want to exert their power. And if you frustrate their ability to exert their power, then they'll become enraged, not just get bored.
They become very enraged.
I think it's a view of bullies that is sort of like a cat playing with a mouse. And that's not what it's like because, you know, if the thing stops moving, the cat loses interest. But if the bullied stop reacting, then the bully will try harder.
Yeah, they get stronger.
Mm-hmm. The real thing that stops bullying, by the way, is people with actual authority and power coming in and showing the bully in no uncertain terms that this will not be tolerated and actually making it stick.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and sometimes you just gotta actually punish the bully.
Now, I have to stop this conversation to bring in our younger guest. Yes. On the show real quickly, because this has been a national story. I don't know if you follow Sean King.
Who, me or?
You.
Yes, I do.
And he made, during this time that he's been covering Ms. Yu as well, made national story of this young black boy's bullying in school, racist bullying by kids. And this is something that you experienced at Horizon Middle School here in Moorhead. And this went on for a long time. The mom was very diligent in documenting things, as I was.
Mm-hmm.
Even recording encounters that my child had with students, with administrators, counselors, etc. To document what was going on in school. And this bullying went on without the administration doing very much of anything other than the bare minimum at the most egregious of instances in this child's case for 3 years, which is why Sean King started showing this as a huge problem for this young man, because he wrote a letter, which Sean King published, showing the desperation of this child.
I read that.
And we published a video showing a test that Lizzie was subjected to at the Horizon Middle School, asking her to validate Speedy Gonzalez as part of her cultural learning for some, what was the class?
It was, I think it was a world languages class where we had to learn different languages from different countries.
World culture and language class. And they were asking in the section they were learning about Mexican culture, about how Speedy Gonzalez, what does Speedy Gonzalez say, and what is in, and how is that, what does Speedy Gonzalez mean to this culture?
Speedy beep and Gonzalez?
Yeah.
It was fun. Good times.
And Lizzie's response, she was so upset, she wrote in there, an insult to my people. And like, and so,
which it is.
And so when the conversation in the class went on about this, and she was very upset and she was saying, this is very insulting. The teacher tried to defend it and say, plenty of people say, andale, andale, ariba, ariba, and it's all, and it's okay to teach this. And
really,
and she was like, no, it's very insulting. And this is a racial stereotype. Speedy Gonzalez is, it's a racist stereotype of our people. Then the fact that she was challenging the teacher on this, and that the teacher was saying, no, this is perfectly acceptable curriculum for the class, turned all the students on Lizzie. And throughout the day, everyone decided to follow her around. And what did they do?
Oh, well, while I was going to my locker and, you know, to and from class, did they say, andale, andale, arriba, arriba. And they'd be like, why do you hate cartoons, Lizzie? And I'm like, dude, I love cartoons. That was super racist, though.
And it culminated with people breaking into her locker and
stealing my iPod, which I loved. There are colored students doing it, too. Like, a black kid behind me, like, took my shoulder while I was standing up and telling the teacher this is racist. And he's like, Lizzie, stop it. You're freaking out. I'm like, black student, no.
Yeah, I mean, that is collateral damage. Like, there's a lot of people of color in within our groups that are like coconuts, and they're like, shh, don't say that.
Maybe they're afraid of reprisal.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, definitely. But,
which I can't really blame them for.
But, you know, that experience to me seems a lot like the kinds of things that people are saying at MizU, because the same, when we brought this up and we talked about how racist that is, how this shouldn't be part of the curriculum, how this is very wrong, how even Disney is, and, you know, these, or was it Warner Brothers? Warner Brothers got rid of that cartoon because it was racist. They didn't acknowledge any of their wrongdoing, and they basically wanted to, let's calm this all down. Why are we talking about the racism part? This seems to be the narrative of the nation's media on this. We don't know that there's a poop swastika. We don't know for sure that there's racism. This president was fired without any wrongdoing being present that we know of in a court of law. So aren't we just listening to all these snot-nosed students that want, they're like the Occupy people. They don't even know what they want. They're just complaining about things mm-hmm. and stuff.
Well, I've noticed that when, say, Jonathan Chait or Richard Cohen or David Brooks or one of those other empty suits in the media wants to rant about, oh, say, the laziness and entitled attitude of millennials, or the fact that higher education is a hotbed of liberalism, or things like that, that they can basically just say whatever they want and offer no evidence to support anything of the sort. And we're expected to just take them at their word and believe them that this is a real thing. Oh, or ranting about PC culture gone too far, or mm-hmm. anything of the sort. But if minorities or women or anybody in a marginalized position comes forward and says, hey, this bad stuff is happening to us, then suddenly the standard of evidence becomes beyond all a reasonable doubt. You must prove it to my the same satisfaction that a court of law would require to convict someone of a crime for me to even take you seriously at all.
As if the court of justice convicted people that are white at the same rate for their crimes as they convict people of color.
Well, yeah, but beyond that, it's just the standard of evidence changes from, oh, well, I heard it from a guy sometime, when it's a white person pompously pontificating about something, to you must prove it to my satisfaction and provide three different citations in triplicate, and I want video evidence, and even if there is video evidence, I will do my best to discredit it and disbelieve it and claim that, for instance, a 15-year-old girl who was flung around in her desk was trying to kick that officer.
Right.
You know, because they imagined, they saw her limbs flail, and therefore they imagined she was.
And also,
aggressive.
We don't know what happened before that.
Of course, we don't know what happened before.
There's no continuing video of her whole life, you know.
True. We do know what happened before that. It starts with the Atlantic slave trade 400 years ago, and pretty much goes on from there. But
yes,
for some reason, the people who say that never want that answer.
No, no. Very good answer, though, Avi, and.
I can't claim credit for it. I saw it on Twitter.
No, it's beautiful, though. It's beautiful, and it's very appropriate, by the way. And I'm going to take us into a musical break. We've got some fantastic protest music for you.
Yeah, and we're searching for public domain music, non-copyrighted music. The first song we heard was actually put out by Samuel L. Jackson.
Woo!
A protest song called I Can't Breathe, and people have been recording that across the country, using it in protests.
Mm-hmm.
The one we're going to play now is actually called the Public Domain Protest Song, the official video. And they really pride themselves on putting music out there that is actually public domain.
And when we come back, we're going to go past this whole Ms. You issue and generalize into the whole Million Student March. Like, we're going to talk about public education. Should it be free? I mean, people want public health care, Obamacare, and what, should people have public education? I want to know what Avi thinks. We're going to talk about this in a minute after this break on KPPPLPFM with a Mexican, Crossing Lines.
This song ain't copyrighted. This song ain't trademarked either. It's a public domain protest song.
The executives on Wall Street, they were reckless. When mistakes don't cost you anything, you do more of them.
Paying taxes, goose egg. I am not trying to start a class war here. I am just saying this is what's going on.
It's not the left, it's not the right. It's up and down, and that's the fight. It's a world of loopholes. It's a way to save ourselves. All we make is constant debt. Watch the facts and you'll forget. Count it off, 1, 2, 3. And play these chords.
Many students agree that two important signs of democracy are shared respect and the shared power.
Extremes of riches and poverty set group against group.
Middle class income shrinking, executive pay, whoa, here it comes.
Profits climb and the jobs get shipped. Bottom 90% gets ripped. Right to work state, what a game. Rob accused of better men. It's not the right. It's up and down, and that's the fight. It's a world of loopholes. SOS, save our souls. Paying for the wealthy's crimes. Let's see some bankers doing time. Free market costs a lot. If this ain't hell, it sure is high.
Because Bank of America didn't pay its taxes. In 2009, Bank of America made $4.44 billion in profit, money left over after the end of the year, and paid zero taxes. That's right, nada, none, zilch.
And children, if your parents haven't been teaching you what it means to be an American, let them know and nail them on it. That would be a very American thing to do.
And we're back. This is A Mexican Crossing Lines. You're listening to KPPPLPFM. We are broadcasting online through live365.com, and you can soon find us on your radio dial at 88.1 FM, adding local color to your airwaves. And I am very happy to have my very special guest, Avi Blackmore.
Hello.
And Lizzie.
Hey.
And we are talking today about Ms. U, but we are also talking about the greater issue of education in America, this Million Student March. This is about free education in America. And some people, especially those on the right, are saying this is a ludicrous claim. Like, what do you want the gravy train for? Why is it that we should demand education as a right? Obamacare demanded healthcare as a right. We're a radical nation here. And I know it didn't come close to really doing that, but this was the premise of what, you know, some of the opposition to healthcare as a right.
Right.
People talked about that. Is healthcare a right? Should you have a right to have health? Should you have a right to have education? What do you think?
Well, first of all, briefly on the healthcare thing, yes, you should have a right to healthcare. And the people who compared the Affordable Care Act, Obamacare as it was dubbed by the right wing, compared that to socialism is, again, it just demonstrates a complete lack of knowledge of what socialism actually is.
But isn't asking for free education also considered a form of socialism within those circles?
Yes, it is. But the problem is that what the right wing imagines socialism to be and what socialism actually is are very different things. But beyond that, there's also the fact that the Affordable Care Act was originally a Republican suggestion.
Can you repeat that? It was a Republican suggestion?
Yeah, it was originally, I can't remember if it was the American Enterprise Institute or the Federalist Society or one of those right-wing or conservative think tanks. I don't want to say hard right, but sort of moderate conservative think tanks came up with the Affordable Care Act model back in the 90s as an alternative.
Well, Mitt Romney ran that in his state, didn't he?
Yes. It was conceived as an alternative to Bill and Hillary Clinton's plan in the early 90s for essentially a public option type of health care.
Yeah, which would have been better.
Yes, it would have been. But the funny thing is, this proposal, which was a conservative proposal. No, I'm sorry, Heritage Foundation. That's who it was originally from. I just remembered. So it was originally a Heritage Foundation suggestion. And Romney, as governor of Massachusetts, implemented it for Massachusetts, and it worked reasonably well. I mean, if you accept the basic idea that there should still be for-profit healthcare, and that the important thing is to regulate it and monitor it and ensure that it doesn't become too abusive, then the ACA isn't bad.
And I know, but it's too late for that.
I know. What I'm saying is, Romney Care in Massachusetts, and then
Romney Care. I never heard that.
Oh yeah, that one got thrown around a lot during the 2012 campaign. Ooh. But in Massachusetts, it worked reasonably well for what it was supposed to do, which was rein in the excessive abuses of for-profit healthcare while still allowing it to exist. Mm-hmm. Doing that on a nationwide scale with the Affordable Care Act, again, works reasonably well. I mean, it's still
for the states that want to opt in.
That was a loophole that they should have closed. But the big problem is that it's not recognizing healthcare as a right. It's treating healthcare as a commodity. And sure, you can say we also treat things like food like a commodities. And sure, there's some truth to that, although we do have an understanding, although in this country less and less all the time, that people have a right to food. But the problem is that when you go to buy food, you can make choices and comparison shop. Mm-hmm. You can say, I don't think I can afford steak. Mm-hmm. I'm going to go with this. Or I need to have a cheaper brand of flour or mm-hmm. sugar. Or I'm going to buy the cheaper brand of bread. You know, you can comparison shop. You have time. You can do the same thing with things like houses, cars, iPhones, or just phones in general. Mm-hmm. I mean, if you don't want an iPhone, you can say, maybe I'll go for an Android instead. It might be cheaper and it might work better for me. But the point is, you're not under extreme pressure, and there's a market, and you can choose. And the problem with treating healthcare that way is that, you know, you can't really comparison shop for emergency rooms when you've just been in a car accident.
Right.
You know, you're out of network. Well, you can go somewhere that isn't in your provider network and then get hit by a car while you're away from the places that your insurance has agreed to
cover
properly. And then be screwed into paying a huge bill because, oh, that's a different hospital. They're not in your provider network. And the notion that people should be thinking in terms of comparison shopping of commodities when it's something like healthcare treatment, especially emergency treatment, but mm-hmm. even non.
Of course, because everything is preventative to keep you from emergency.
Well, yeah. And if you're going to like a primary care doctor, and you only have one choice in your town, it's a small town. I mean, Fargo-Moorhead is big enough to have a few hospitals to choose from. You know, we've got Sanford, we've got Essentia. I forget who else we have now.
I'm drawing a blank too.
I think we just have those two now, actually.
Yeah.
But we have choices, and there's a number of different doctors you can choose from in town. In a really small rural area, you may not have that choice. Mm-hmm. And if the choice is bad, or if your physician just isn't able to provide you with the necessary treatment without you paying right then and there, that's not going to work.
You're not going to get healthcare.
Right. As far as education goes, yeah, you could say,
but we have to race this because, you know what, higher education is very much decidedly elite, rich people and mostly white people world.
That is very true. Yes, it's hopefully becoming less so, but it is still the case that the structure of academia is very much built around European cultural assumptions for the most part.
And the majority of the administration
are going to be
teachers
white.
Are all going to be white.
Right. But as far as the need for education, you asked if I believed education should be a right.
Right.
Yes. But I also believe that education can be viewed as an investment.
Do you believe education should be a right all the way through college and maybe grad school or what? I mean, I want you to define it. Should people, most people, for example, in the Constitution of Mexico, you get an education, and what that translates into in real terms is that most people can get an education through sixth grade for free in Mexico. And if you have the resources, you could go to public universities. As you explained to me, public universities used to be free.
In this country, in many states, public universities were free. University of California was free from when it was founded until the 1960s, when then Governor Reagan spearheaded an initiative to make it require tuition and then cut its funding.
Listen up, Reaganites. Something else to celebrate.
But as far as how far she should go, well, let's take some of those super socialist Nordic countries as an example.
Mm-hmm.
Finland, for instance, they will pay completely for your education all the way through your PhD if you choose to get one.
What?
They have free education for everyone. Norway, what? Sweden, similar. And the thing is, they have some of the best schools in the world. They also have less homework. They meet less often than we do.
Okay, I'm going to throw a rock at you here.
Ow!
Here's something that a lot of the people are saying, especially about the Bernie Sanders campaign. They're like, oh yeah, Bernie Sanders brings up all that stuff about these countries and Norwegians and these Denmark people, blah, blah, blah. We have a much larger population. We can't scale that to our population. That won't work in our society.
We have a much larger economy, too. We have a much larger GDP. We have so much wealth, this country. Affording it is not a problem. I mean, we could cut our defense budget in half and still not only be outspending all of our allies.
Oh, that's a sin right there. You just blasphemed on the radio.
I'm well aware of the right wing's worship of the military, but frankly,
we might be get taken off the air for that.
Oh, hush. No, seriously, we could, if we were to say cut our defense budget in half, we would still not only have the largest military in the world, but we would be able to afford education for
everyone.
Everyone. Hell, if we just canceled the billions and billions of dollars being spent on the failed F-35 program,
right?
We could afford to pay for college education for everyone in the country.
So is this a far-fetched idea? Because it seems to be like,
no,
people act as if this is an insurmountable goal. We couldn't possibly provide an higher ed education for every American.
Well, first of all, I'm going to say that I do actually believe that there should be a place in the modern world for people who don't get a higher education.
Oh, me too. Amen.
Because besides the fact that we devalue the kinds of jobs that you only need a high school diploma to get,
mm-hmm.
skilled labor that you would apprentice into instead of going to a university or college.
Not for white folks, because as a black college graduate, you can earn less
than a white high school only graduate. Yes, I know. But
I love how you finish my sentences.
Well, we've talked about this before.
I know we have.
But as far as
I know that education. You love it, though. You know it and you love it.
Okay. But as far as the education goes, and as far as requiring everybody to go to college, see, I think that there needs to be, among many, many other things, recognition that not only does not everybody learn the same way, not everybody should have to learn all of the same sorts of things or go mm-hmm. through the same educational process
right.
in order to get to a point where they're acceptable to work. And I mean, not without getting into the whole topic about how I believe the way we structure work and how we believe and jobs and how we believe that people are their jobs. And when we say, what do you want to be when you grow up? We always mean, how do you want to sell your labor? Not what kind of person do you want to be?
And up until very recently, that was a question mostly for men.
True. Very true. But even that aside, I mean, there's the whole interwoven mixture of racism, sexism, capitalist classism, the various other bigotries and privileges, and this whole interwoven hierarchy of oppression and privileging that happens. But I, for the moment, want to follow one thread just because, just to pare down the variables for
yeah,
a second.
Yeah, no, I totally agree with you.
So as far as, I think that we need to recognize that people can contribute to society in different ways, and that requiring someone to be able to do something that someone else is willing to pay them for in order to make a living is a really wrong-headed way of organizing society. There's a large number of pursuits that are hard to make a living at, like doing various forms of art or music or writing. The arts in general is very devalued in this country, unless it's marketable. And that itself has a whole host of connotations behind it that implies a certain valuation and a value structure that, you know, something needs to be marketable in order to succeed. That means that it needs to appeal to some
elite.
Yeah, to someone in a position of power
and money
who has the money to be able to fund this. And if you don't, then how are you going to make money? And this is seen as a failing of the artist or the writer or the singer or whatever, because they are not
appealing it to the money.
They're not marketable is the problem. Instead of, well, the resources are hoarded by a small elite group of people who then choose to dole them out to those that they see fit. And
based on their own biases.
Uh-huh, of course. And it's a self-perpetuating because their own biases are the biases that support the power structure that gives them their power. So, of course, it's a self-perpetuating machine. But as far as education goes, if with the caveat that we should look at education differently, we should look at how work works differently, we should look at the notion that requiring people to have college degrees for some jobs doesn't make a whole lot of sense, and that requiring people even to have jobs doesn't always make sense.
Now you're getting deep.
Right, but if we put all that to the side for the second, then looking at the notion that education, which is increasingly becoming a requirement in our society just to get any kind of job that is not
survive,
that is higher than minimum wage.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, of course, minimum wage needs to be raised too, but that's a whole separate kettle of fish. Given that education is becoming a requirement, if something becomes a requirement for maintaining society's expected standard of living, then I would say in that society, it becomes a right. So if...
That is deep.
I would say that in the 19th century, no one had a right to electricity because hardly anybody had electricity.
Right?
And those that did, either it was very experimental or it was not really necessary to their lives. But when electricity became vital for maintaining American standard of living, they started projects like the rural electrification in the 30s. And electricity now is considered almost a right.
Indoor plumbing. Garbage pickup.
Mm-hmm.
Telephone
access.
Telephone access was a thing. Now we have lost that because we had laws that required that everyone could have telephone access, so that you could call 911.
But they don't apply to cell phones. But now there are still programs in place to give cell phone access to people who don't have it otherwise.
They're not very good.
No, they're not very good. And the part of the problem is that the so-called...
They're run by the companies.
Exactly. The so-called Obama phone program, but I don't know if you've heard of this.
I know.
It's oh, you have?
Yeah, I do.
Okay. Yeah, the so-called Obama phones, that's actually not a federal program.
No.
It was started during the Bush years by the cell phone companies.
Mm-hmm.
And it's still entirely paid for by them, not by the federal government.
They always want to maintain that control. But I only have 5 minutes and I have to ask you one more very important thing to this show.
Of course.
Now we're going to bring it local.
All right.
Because this situation that happened at Ms. U has really kind of set off a chain reaction across the country.
Yeah, with student protests over racism at various schools, Yale, Ithaca.
And the question is, well, from the right, what was the racism? Is the racism there? Is it even there? But the other thing is, too, do you think that is a local problem that we have to look at?
Of course it is.
And what do people in our local universities need to examine? Because I think we've had especially with the mascot issues and things that have been happening at our local universities, we have to really examine whether or not this is an issue we need to look at in our states, Minnesota, North Dakota.
Right. Well, of course it's an issue around here. I have not been in college in a good long time. It's never mind how long, but race has always been an issue. I mean,
do you have any doubts that it's an issue now?
Of course not. Of course not. It's an issue everywhere in this country. And so why should here be any different? After all, we are a majority white community. And while Minnesotan and North Dakotan types, at least, you know, the people around here are generally friendly and nice, they're also people. And they're also white. And we know from that, I forget which department it was, the Minnesota's, they did that report some 15 years ago on the state of race relations in Moorhead specifically.
The Minnesota Advisory Council to the Department of, no, I'm doing it wrong.
The Minnesota Advisory Committee to the U.S. Department on Civil Rights.
You're awesome.
It was done in 2001, and it was a status of minorities in Moorhead.
Thanks. Thank you very much. I didn't remember the title of it, so.
We'll put the link up on
definitely.
With this podcast so you can find it and check it out for yourself.
That report, some 14 years ago, detailed a variety of failings in this community. Mm-hmm. This specific community dealing with race relations in matters of policing, housing, education access.
Employment.
Employment. Education was in there.
Huge.
And not just in our public schools, but in the colleges and universities as well.
I know.
And that has raised issues.
Most of those findings were never actually changed. I mean, like, there was no action taken in our community.
Right. They were problems then. And the problems have not gone away. And the fact that our mostly white leadership in this community, and I don't just mean political leadership, business leadership, media leadership, movers and shakers, the people in charge of various nonprofit organizations, mm-hmm. The people who do various news shows, mm-hmm. I'm looking at you, Valley News Live. these people, you know, they're mostly white, and many of them don't care, or they don't understand. Even if they do want to care, they don't really understand. They can't get past the white fragility of saying, no, it's about race. I'm not comfortable.
Well, you know, there's a lot of stuff that happened on this, especially at MSUM's campus recently, with regard to the spaces that were going to be allotted for a Native American center for the different smaller minority organizations, including the Rainbow Dragon Center for the LGBT. Those discussions have kind of been silenced and kind of swept under the rug in the way that it seems to me that a lot of the issues about racism and discrimination on campus have been swept under the rug at many of these universities like Ithaca and Yale and, of course, Ms. U, which are coming to a head. And we are seeing now that universities across the country are rising in solidarity to support this movement of students. I think that it is a radical time in our history, and it is an amazing conversation that we can have right now about how we can change what is happening at the educational level, at the higher ed level in our universities with regard to race, with regard to what the values that we place on education are, and how we reform the educational system, because by God, it needs to be reformed. It is definitely in need of serious reform, especially higher ed.
Mm-hmm.
I have had a magnificent time talking about this topic. I really want to hear what my listeners have to say about Ms. Yu, what's happening across the country with the Million Student March. You've been listening to A Mexican Crossing Lines. This is Cindy Azucena Gomez-Shemp, and I've been here with my special guest, Avi Blackmore.
Hello.
And Lizzie.
Hey.
Thank you for sharing this time with us. You've been listening to KPPP LPFM. We are broadcasting through live365.com. You can find us on your radio at 88.1 FM, adding local color to your airwaves. What are you going to take us out with today, Duke?
Well, we're going to listen to part of a Billie Holiday song, Strange Fruit, and it's actually mm-hmm. a copyrighted song, but under the doctrine of fair use, since we are talking about a guest posting on Valley News Live, talking about lynching, we figured we should play a song that's actually talking about lynching.
Yeah.
Southern trees bear strange fruit, blood on the leaves and blood at the root, black bodies swinging in the southern breeze. Strange fruit hanging from the poplar trees. Pastoral scene of the gallant south, the bulging eyes and the twisted mouth, scent of magnolia, sweet and fresh. Then the sudden smell of burning flesh. Here is a fruit for the crows to pluck, for the rain to gather.